began to set up the new department. It was essential for the police to recognize us and call us out, so tedious though it was, I had to create a sound management and financial structure. After a few months of this, I was surprised to find myself missing the mortuary, where I could use the skills I'd honed over so many years. When a pathologist friend on the South Coast went on holiday, I agreed to fill in for his routine coronial postmortems. It was the school's summer holidays. Anna and Chris were teenagers now. Anna was still at school, but Chris had just finished his GCSEs and was hanging around at home, so I offered to take him with me. If he waited while I did a few quick routine postmortems for the coroner, no homicides here, just sudden natural deaths which required an explanation. Then afterwards, we could go for a walk along the cliff tops. Chris was a relaxed sort of boy who was up for anything, so he was happy to sit reading in the car while I went into the mortuary to work. I put on my kit. The mortuary staff had lined the bodies up on tables and prepared them for me. In those days, that meant the bodies were still opened up, with the rib cages removed and skulls opened too. There was the usual small talk with the coroner's officer, during which I happened to mention that my son was waiting for me, reading in the car. The coroner's officer clearly saw this as borderline neglect. "I'll bring him to the office. He'll be more comfortable in there," he offered. "He can have a cup of tea." I was busy over an open body, PM40 in hand, when in the corner of my eye I saw Chris. He was walking through the post-mortem room with the coroner's officer. He seemed unperturbed. I, however, was extremely perturbed. I wanted to shout, "Get him out of here!" But I knew that would make the mortuary seem even more shocking for an unprepared teenager. So, with a supreme effort of will, I winked at him from behind my mask and waved my PM40 jauntily. To tell the truth, I felt unmasked. All these years I had shielded my children from the reality of my work, without actually lying to them or misleading them, and now Chris had been unexpectedly exposed to it. As we walked along the cliff tops afterwards, there was a sort of mumbling between father and son. "Were you all right with what you saw at the mortuary?" "Didn't really bother me," he said, "but the coroner's officer was an idiot." Whatever subject they differed over, football, I think, it was more memorable for Chris than the sights and sounds of a working post-mortem room. He and Anna had sometimes actually come to the mortuary with me when I was working, so they were familiar with the smells and the clangs and the general ethos of the place. If the bereavement room was empty, they would sprawl over the chairs doing their homework beneath the fish tank, while beaming staff plied them with tea and biscuits. They had never actually asked what I was doing there, out of sight. I did hope, without voicing this, that Chris wouldn't breathe a word at home about his expedition through the post-mortem room. And so, of course, he told Anna. "Can I come to a post-mortem?" she demanded. "It's not fair if Chris has been and I haven't." "I wouldn't exactly call that coming to a post-mortem," I said. And by now Jen had overheard. "You saw what?" she asked Chris, throwing me an accusatory look. "I'll have to get used to that sort of thing if I'm going to be a vet," said Chris bravely. "I'll have to cut up dead things all the time." "Well, I'm going to be a vet too," said Anna, "or a doctor." Ours was a medical household, and incidents and cases were routinely discussed, often quite candidly, although I still hid the case photos. If asked what their parents did, the children still answered, "They're doctors." If pushed, they would say, "Dad cuts up dead bodies," which usually prevented any further questions. But on the whole, it was much easier to explain that their mother was a GP who was specializing in dermatology than that their father was a forensic pathologist. In a few years, Chris and Anna would both be off to university. It was hard to imagine them as independent people, leading independent lives. It was hard to imagine they wouldn't need me anymore. I determined that, although my new job would certainly be demanding, I should try to spend as much time with them as possible before they left. Chapter 27. Once I had started up the department, I was back in the mortuary, and this became a busy, productive period. Other staff arrived. Rob Chapman, a friend and excellent pathologist from Guy's, joined me, and two secretaries, Rhiannon Lane and Kathy Paler. And so did two clinical forensic doctors, Debbie Rogers and Margaret Stark. They examined the living victims of crime, and they also looked after the medical needs of the people who had been arrested and detained in police cells. These were the first academic clinical forensic posts in the UK, a great asset to our embryonic department. In addition, we had a trainee pathologist. Very quickly, we became nationally and internationally recognised, and that meant we were busy almost at once. Being boss gave me the chance, to some extent, to choose my cases. One very difficult area I would have liked to palm off onto my colleagues was the very area I'd been immersed in with my last case at Guy's, babies. But I could see that wasn't fair, because now everything was changing in the pathology of child death, and this reflected society's changing attitude to children. I realised that now I probably would have given a different cause of death for the baby of that drunken mother. From the early 1990s, the number of SIDS deaths, or deaths diagnosed as SIDS, significantly declined, and that decline has continued. The most recent statistics tell us that SIDS now accounts for only 0.27 deaths per 1,000 live births. The improvement was largely due to the worldwide campaign called Back to Sleep in the UK, which persuaded parents to stop putting their babies face down in bed, as this had been identified as a major risk factor in SIDS. Other factors we knew of included adults in the house smoking, adults sleeping on the sofa or in bed with the baby, which could result in overlaying or rolling onto the child, alcohol or substance abusing parents, too much bedding, and too high a room temperature. With all this knowledge, and an education program for parents, the numbers fell. Numbers also fell because perceptions of SIDS changed, and consequently the fundamentals of its diagnosis. It was now sometimes referred to as a diagnostic dustbin, and guidelines for pathologists were tightened up. The thinking was that, before diagnosing SIDS, we should examine very carefully first the history, both the child's medical history and the caregiver's story of events, then the scene itself, and finally the pathology of the deceased child. There isn't really any positive pathology for SIDS. It's a question of confirming the absence of every other possible cause of death. And why, really, were guidelines tightening up and people talking about SIDS as a diagnostic dustbin? Simply because many pathologists did not follow the criteria laid down for its use and gave it for any death they couldn't explain. And often these deaths were under-investigated by both the police and the pathologist. SIDS had become such a catch-all that there were now unpalatable suspicions. Could it be that some so-called SIDS cases might be acts of adults rather than God? Those uncomfortable suspicions were rooted in the pioneering child protection work of Professor David Southall and his colleagues. In the light of evidence he produced, it was hard not to face facts. He was involved in studies which not only identified Munchausen syndrome by proxy, parents with this mental disorder deliberately make their children ill in order to receive attention and support, but also produced irrefutable evidence through covert video surveillance that some parents certainly do attempt to injure or even kill their children for reasons that are unclear. In his most famous investigation, 39 children who had recurrent episodes of apparently life-threatening events, usually outside hospital but sometimes on a hospital ward, were referred to a specialist ward where they were secretly filmed. In 33 cases, these events turned out to be induced by a parent. The covert footage showed instances not just of emotional abuse, but also poisoning, strangulation, and especially suffocation. In fact, there were no fewer than 30 attempts at suffocation in just this small group. Thanks to the surveillance, professional intervention protected the children. But between them, those children had 41 siblings, of whom 12 had died suddenly and unexpectedly. Once the parents were exposed, 4 actually admitted to killing 8 of these siblings. When these sibling cases were reviewed, it was found that, in 11 of the 12 cases, the cause of death given by the pathologist who had performed the post-mortem was SIDS. In the 12th case, the cause given had been gastroenteritis, but further investigation now revealed the child had been poisoned. 15 more of the 41 siblings were later discovered to have suffered abuse. Naturally, there was widespread shock at these findings and considerable disbelief. I feel, as a result of David Southall's work, we started to move out of an age of innocence. A lot of people, however, preferred innocence. It was hard to accept that there were children who needed protection from the very adults who should be protecting them. Suspicion gradually became an almost routine response to the unexplained death of a baby, and that must have felt very unfair to the innocent. So unfair that David Southall faced vitriolic and vocal opposition. The ethics of his covert video surveillance of parents came in for particular criticism. I fear that, without it, he would never have been believed. So incredible did his results seem at that time. Parents, as well as many police officers and even social workers, who had once regarded any concern from outside the family for the welfare of children as an invasion of privacy, were now forced to accept change. Adult victims of all sorts of parental abuse were talking publicly about their childhoods, and a light was shining onto family secrets in a way that had been impossible when privacy was king. That light was held by professionals working with children, health visitors, doctors, nursery staff, who are now encouraged to report any suspicions of abuse. As child protection became a subject for national debate, the discussion about unexplained baby deaths left theory behind and became concentrated in the specifics of just one case. I'm talking about the trial of Sally Clark. SIDS had once taken a cruel harvest from right across the social spectrum. But as the middle classes became informed about risk factors and minimized them, SIDS began to look like something more likely to affect the poor. Until, in 1996, Sally Clark, a well-off, middle-class solicitor and policeman's daughter, whose background and bearing reflected that of so many respectable, professional, working mothers, lost first one baby to SIDS, and then, in 1997, another. The first baby, a boy, was 11 weeks old. Sally Clark's husband, Stephen, also a lawyer, was out at the office party when his wife found the baby unconscious. She called an ambulance, but for some reason she was unable to open the door when it arrived. The baby, the paramedics discovered, had no pulse and had been cyanosed, meaning his lips and fingers were blue, for some time. But he was only officially declared dead after an hour when resuscitation attempts failed. The pathologist who conducted the subsequent post-mortem was worried by particular injuries, a split and bruise at the top of the baby's mouth, inside the lips, and the absence of any obvious cause of death. He had these injuries photographed, and it is very unfortunate that the photographer's camera was not working properly, and the resulting pictures were of such poor quality that they were to prove absolutely unhelpful in the furore that followed. That was extreme bad luck. I've only come across such decisive camera failure one other time in my entire career. When the pathologist discussed his worries with the police and the coroner's officer, he had to agree that the split inside the baby's lip could have been caused by the resuscitation attempt. In the case of these particular injuries, such a cause would be rare. Damage to that part of the mouth is indicative of abuse, but it is certainly possible that they occurred during the frantic hour of resuscitation. The police and the coroner's officer chose to believe the cause was the attempted resuscitation, and there was no further investigation. They were dealing with a well-off, professional family, not the kind of criminals or child abusers they normally encountered. The baby had been x-rayed and no broken bones found. The pathologist had taken histology samples, and these were pretty much normal, all except for the very small possibility, certainly not a probability, of some increase of inflammatory cells in a sample from the lungs. He might have exonerated the parents by giving SIDS, or, in view of the baby's injuries, he might have aired the possibility of an unnatural death by giving unascertained. Times were changing fast, but the fact is, in 1996, he may also have been working for a conservative, one might even say Luddite, coroner. In those days, any lawyer or medical practitioner with a few years under their belt could become a coroner. I do not know the coroner involved in this case, but many of them, exclusively those who did not have a medical qualification, were still struggling with the concept of SIDS because it was a cause of death based on no definable evidence. And some coroners also disliked the word unascertained, particularly when applied to babies. They wanted to say kind, comforting things to grief-stricken parents, not, we don't know why your baby's dead. Limitations like this could leave a pathologist in limbo. For whatever reason, the pathologist seized on the slides from the lung sample with their suggestion of inflammation and decided that the baby had died of natural causes. In fact, lower respiratory tract infection. The child's death was treated as natural. But the following year, the Clark's second baby died too. He had been a few weeks premature, but he was fine now at 2 months old. Sally Clark breastfed him and supplemented that with bottled milk. One evening, her husband went to prepare a bottle for the night feed, leaving the mother to watch TV while the baby lay in his bouncy chair. When she saw that her son was limp, she called her husband and rang an ambulance. The paramedics found the baby dead. The same pathologist was involved, and this time discovered injuries that suggested to him this baby may have been shaken, perhaps on several occasions over several days. He believed he had found hemorrhages in the eyes and spinal cord, as well as some abnormalities of the ribs which suggested that there had been previous fracture or trauma. Sally Clark and her husband were arrested on suspicion of the murder of their second child, and while they were being interviewed about his death, the pathologist quite rightly went back to his report on the death of the first child. In this, he was complying with Home Office guidelines, which state that if previously held conclusions can no longer be substantiated, then any change of opinion must be promptly and clearly stated, irrespective of any possible embarrassment. The pathologist did change his opinion and was to suffer prolonged and considerable embarrassment. Examining the microscope slides once again, which had possibly, but not probably, shown a lung inflammation in the first child, he decided that the cause of death he had previously given was entirely wrong. He decided that there was no inflammation. He had discovered blood in the baby's alveoli, but had not even mentioned it before. He later said he had assumed this was simply consistent with changes after death, but he had since found that the nature of this finding might be abnormal and that it was consistent with asphyxiation. At this point, as many experts subsequently pointed out, he might have kept the question open by revising the cause of death from lower respiratory tract infection to unascertained. One expert witness explained in the later court case why he personally would have done this. Unascertained means that the child's death may have been natural but without explanation. Perhaps what the jury knows as a cot death. Or it might be that the child died unnaturally, but I can't find out why. Or it might be the child died of a natural disease that I'm not clever enough to diagnose and recognize. But the pathologist did not choose unascertained. Instead, he submitted a further statement saying that he no longer believed the first child had died of natural causes. The Voltfast concluded that there is evidence he died from an asphyxial mechanism, such as smothering. 6 weeks after her arrest for the murder of her second son, Sally Clark was also arrested for the murder of her first. At her trial, the jury famously heard evidence from the pediatrician, Professor Sir Roy Meadow, who had popularized, if he did not actually coin the maxim, one sudden death in a family is a tragedy, two is suspicious, and three is murder, unless proved otherwise. A memorable statistic was unfortunately added at Sally Clark's trial, which was to become associated with Professor Meadow forever. The chance of two children dying naturally in these circumstances is very, very long odds indeed. One in 73 million. One in 73 million was a headline grabber and may have sealed the defendant's fate. He went on to say, "It's the chance of backing that long odds outsider at the Grand National. Let's say it's an 80-1 chance. You back the winner last year. Then the next year there's another horse at 80-1 and you back it again and it wins. You know, to get to these odds of 73 million, you've got to back that 1 in 80 chance 4 years running." Sally Clark was found guilty by a jury majority of 10-2 of both murders and sentenced to life imprisonment. I was not directly involved in this case, but it affected all of us. Her conviction, and David Southall's work, was indicating that the murder of babies was much more common than we had all assumed, and parents who murder their children are more common than we would have thought possible. Even nice, middle-class professional parents. We pathologists were called upon to offer a medical and scientific analysis within the context of society's current thinking, and I'm sorry to tell you, the purity of scientific truth rarely cuts through contemporary social attitudes. Personally, I could never forget how I had walked an endlessly wailing, lactose-intolerant baby around the house, night after night thinking, insofar as one can think over the noise of penetrating screams, that I would do almost anything for some sleep. I knew that the middle classes, even without the pressures of poverty or isolation, were as vulnerable as other parents to extreme desperation. Soon after Sally Clark's trial, a case of mine reflected what had now become the great controversy of child protection. When I saw this 6-month-old baby in the mortuary, he seemed to have been healthy and well cared for, but I was quickly aware of a distinctive triad of symptoms. He had a subdural hemorrhage, that is, a bleeding on the surface of the brain. The brain itself was swollen, and his eyes had hemorrhages in the retinas. These three symptoms, particularly without external signs of injury, were now regarded as the classic triad of symptoms of what was then called shaken baby syndrome. In the 1940s, a radiologist, John Caffey, reported multiple fractures of varying ages in some children and initially thought this was a new disease. Later research showed the fractures were due to repeated trauma, and in the 1960s, the term battered baby syndrome was first used. Then, in the 1970s, a neurological variant, shaken baby syndrome, was recognized as a form of whiplash by neurosurgeon Norman Guth Kelch. So these syndromes and their root cause in deliberately inflicted trauma were medically well known. However, they were only brought to public attention in 1997 by the famous case of the medical couple in Massachusetts who had left their baby in the care of a 19-year-old English au pair. When the baby suddenly became ill and was rushed to hospital, he showed that classic triad of symptoms, and in the televised court case that obsessed America, young Louise Woodward was found guilty of murder. Many Americans were outraged when this charge was changed afterwards by the judge to manslaughter because he felt that there really was not sufficient evidence beyond reasonable doubt for a murder conviction. And that was because medical experts were so divided about shaken baby syndrome. This was not the end of the story because by now shaken baby syndrome itself had become the story. Most people had never heard of it before Louise Woodward's trial, and suddenly it was in the headlines and every pathologist was on full alert for the now famous triad of symptoms. In fact, as a cause of death, it was then, and is now, highly controversial and the subject of much scientific and medical argument. Shaken baby syndrome, now also called abusive head injury or non-accidental head injury, has created its own angry groups of protesters and deniers. There is an ongoing search for natural causes to explain it. Long after Sally Clark's imprisonment in 2009, the Royal College of Pathologists attempted to bring together the various sides of the debate, and this disparate group was able to issue a statement on what they called traumatic head injury, which was yet another name for just the same thing, reminding pathologists that even if all elements of the triad are present, each may have other non-traumatic causes. The statement said clearly that the triad alone is not enough to say a parent harmed a baby beyond reasonable doubt. More evidence would be needed for that. And special care should be taken interpreting the injuries when the baby is under 3 months old, because they might, possibly, have been caused during birth. It looked like a consensus. However, if anything, the debate became more heated. 40 years after first describing the features of this particular type of head injury, Norman Guth Kelch, in 2012, reviewed its history and expressed concern. While society is rightly shocked by an assault on its weakest members and demands retribution, there seem to have been instances in which medical science and the law has gone too far in hypothesizing and criminalizing alleged acts of violence in which the only evidence has been the presence of the classic triad, or even just one or two of its elements. At the end of the 1990s, shaken baby syndrome was very firmly on the pathologist's radar, and the 6-month-old baby I saw seemed to show every relevant symptom. According to his mother, however, he had launched himself from his car seat, which she'd placed on a work surface, with no prior warning that he was physically capable of doing such a thing. As a result, he had fallen out of the seat and about 1 meter down onto a hard kitchen floor. Even a few years earlier, I would have been reluctant to believe her. But post-Woodward, I had very grave concerns indeed. The mother came from an impoverished and war-torn nation, and had been brought by her husband to live in London with his mother and various other family members. She spoke no English. Their accommodation was overcrowded. She still had a relationship with her husband, but because there was so little room in the family flat, had recently begun to live separately in housing that had, it seemed, been provided by the council. Her flat was clean and airy, but apart from a bed and a television, she had no furniture and evidently just sat on the floor. She seemed to spend all day there alone. Outside the family, whom she seldom saw, she only knew one person in London, and that friend lived far away. I thought of my desperation with the wailing baby Chris all those years ago, and pitied this woman for the utter isolation in which she lived, far from home, with this small baby. She had no car, of course, but carried her son around the flat in his car seat. When she made meals, she took him to the kitchen and perched his seat on the work surface. He was not strapped in. One evening, she was busy preparing the food, heard a loud thump, a sickening thud, a word which often seemed to crop up in court, and turned around to find the baby face down on the floor. He cried immediately, but his eyes rapidly became staring and his breathing erratic. It was clear something was very wrong. She tried to phone 999, but was unable to make herself understood. She tried to phone her husband, who spoke English, but the emergency services were still blocking the line. She ran down to the street to get someone else to phone 999, but by that time the police had already responded to her distressed, although incomprehensible, call. They found a baby, with blood coming from his nose and mouth, shaking slowly and losing consciousness. The police would not let the mother get into the ambulance, and the baby was rushed to hospital in an apparently deteriorating condition. CT scans revealed severe internal injuries, but initially it seemed he would probably survive. However, his cardiovascular system became unstable, and in spite of all attempts at resuscitation, he died 12 hours after his mother had called the emergency services. So far as we know, natural causes for the three individual symptoms, which are together suggestive of shaken baby syndrome, like blood clotting difficulties, are very rare. While one should always be alert for these rare natural causes, I felt that a bleeding, swollen brain and bleeding retinas indicated that the baby had received a major trauma. Sometimes that trauma may be an accident, like a car crash, and sometimes, particularly if there are no external marks, it is not an accident. In this case, I was further convinced that the baby had been shaken because despite the internal hemorrhages, there was no fracture of the skull, no bruising of the head, no trauma at all on the outside to show that he had plummeted from a work surface onto a hard floor. He had the triad, although no trauma to the spinal cord at the neck, which is another associated symptom. The mother was tried for manslaughter. The defense pathologist felt that the baby's injuries meant he had been subjected to either an acceleration-deceleration trauma, shaking, or a head impact. He did agree that, in a six-month-old baby, shaking is the most common cause of such internal injuries, and added that it is sometimes unclear whether shaking or impact is the more important factor, since babies who are shaken are then sometimes thrown forcefully down. However, his overall opinion was that the brain swelling alone had killed this baby, and that the injuries therefore confirmed the mother's story. Appearing for the prosecution, I had briefed counsel on this and pointed out the lack of bruising or external mark at all resulting from the alleged fall. When this was put to the defense pathologist, he cited the famous case of a two-year-old who fell off a stool just about half a meter high in McDonald's and died because her brain was so swollen, with no obvious external injuries. The jury decided that the mother in this case was not guilty of manslaughter. She walked free. A year later, she had another son. The local authority knew that she had been acquitted, but they believed there was still enough evidence to suggest that the next child might not be safe in her hands. They set in motion care proceedings to remove the new baby. In the Crown Court, a mother charged with manslaughter would be convicted only if her guilt is beyond reasonable doubt. The family court, which hears the local authority's request to remove her next child from her, must reconsider her case all over again. but apply a different level of proof. The family court applies the lower standard of proof, the balance of probabilities, to reach its conclusions. That can be defined as a 50.1% chance of guilt, a lower standard of proof than the standard of proof that is beyond reasonable doubt. So different courts can reach different conclusions based on the different levels of proof they require. And it often happens that the Crown Court does not have enough evidence to convict for the death of a child, but the family court feels there is sufficient evidence to remove the living sibling of that child. And so truth, that elastic commodity I once thought so immutable, becomes a question not of fact, but of definition. No one can be criminally convicted because they are guilty on the balance of probabilities. Even if the family court decides, using this definition of guilt, that a parent has most probably killed their child, the parent is free. And because these courts are entirely closed to press and public, no one will ever know. Although they might be aware that the court has ordered any surviving or future children be taken away, or that some other safeguarding option has been chosen for them. The family court's sole aim is not to jail parents, it is to safeguard children. And that is what happened in the case of the woman who said her child had fallen from his car seat. For pathologists, the chasm between two courts and two standards of guilt can be a nightmare. According to our evidence about the death of a first child, innocent, bereaved parents may never be allowed to keep future children. Or alternatively, we may be exposing a second child to a killer parent. The universal tendency to leniency where mothers are concerned, of which everyone, including me early in my career, has been guilty, is a symptom of the deep human compassion most people feel for parents under pressure. I only have to think of baby Chris to feel that same compassion right now. If poverty had been knocking at my door, debts climbing in the window, chaos pervading every air molecule in the house, would I have been able to bridle my exasperation? Without the luxury of a quiet place to escape to in the house, would I have been able to stop exhaustion and strain spilling into fury? Compassion certainly has its place, but in the case of child abuse, we must extend our compassion to those who may not yet even be born. When society, when pathologists, finally realized how widespread child murder and abuse was, each baby death assumed a double importance. Justice for the deceased, yes, but the safety of other children in the family became paramount. Our tendency to leniency no longer had a place. Sometimes, a year or more after a baby has been buried, we return to the file because another child has been born, and there is the question now of safeguarding the living. By that time, a fuller picture of the baby's life and death may have emerged. Parents' abusive, neglectful, or simply absent care may have been exposed or histories uncovered. The whole case has a new slant, so we reopen the file and review it. Of all the files I revisit, baby cases, that minefield of moral and emotional ordnance, are the ones I examine and re-examine the most. When I moved to St. George's, I would have liked simply to avoid them. But as the 1990s wore on, it became obvious that the question of babies and why they died was at the heart of forensic pathology and must be addressed by everyone, including me. Chapter 28. There was another change in our profession, one that seemed to accelerate at an alarming rate when I arrived at St. George's, the stress involved in court appearances. Forensic pathologists of the past were household names, and every newspaper reader between the wars knew who Sir Bernard Spilsbury was, a sort of Sherlock Holmes figure whose brilliant analysis of any case ensured that, if he were appearing for the prosecution, the defendant would be hanged. Long after his death, the icon's cases were re-examined, and his logic found sometimes to be less than Holmesian. But at the time, it was unthinkable to challenge him. His successor was my own hero, Professor Keith Simpson. Simpson, whom, at the end of his career and beginning of mine, I had actually breathlessly watched carrying out a post-mortem, was a man with far more humanity and humour than Spilsbury. But he, too, operated in the days when the expert witness was held in such regard that he was rarely challenged. In my early years of practice, court appearances hadn't been too bad. In the first months, I avoided controversial cases if I could, although it was hard to know in advance what would turn into a circus. In general, counsel just wanted the facts from the pathologist. There was then still, if not the respect of earlier ages, at least its residue. However, by the time I reached St. George's, barristers had begun to see post-mortem reports as a possible chink in the opposition's armour, and more regarded the testimony of the expert witness as an opportunity to stick the knife into the other side. Some pathologists enjoy this, but anyone with macho pretensions, courtroom barracking is the professional equivalent of a Saturday night fight, and there are many who are ready to roll up their sleeves. Watching their courtroom appearances would leave me open-mouthed and incredulous. QC, do you mean to tell me that you are absolutely sure that the knife wounds were inflicted while the deceased was lying down? Confident colleague, I do. QC, you are certain? Colleague, I am. QC, but are you aware that we have heard from two witnesses that he was last seen walking down the Old Kent Road? Colleague, I am aware of all witness statements. QC, then will you perhaps entertain the possibility he... Colleague, I will not. QC, you will not even say there is a possibility that... Colleague, I'm sorry that I have to remind you I have sworn an oath today. An oath to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Therefore, you can produce a witness saying the deceased was playing Premier League football, or that he was walking down the Old Kent Road, or anything at all. But it is still my duty, my oath, my role as an expert witness to tell the truth, and only the truth as I see it. And therefore I tell you that this man was stabbed as he lay on his back. How I envied that colleague. I knew I could never be like him. In those circumstances, I cannot but admit the possibility, however slim, that I may be wrong, that there are other explanations, other versions of the truth. While my job requires me, at the same time, to insist that I have reached the correct conclusion. My favourite court was the one that, in theory at least, is non-adversarial and informal, the coroner's court. Here the coroner is leading an inquiry into the truth. Here is the deceased wife, sitting an arm's length away, red-eyed, anxious for the truth but fearing it, still shocked many months after the death. Here are the deceased's children, tearful, angry, telling the coroner they don't think it was an accident and they have a good idea who was involved. Here are his friends, awkward, supportive, overawed by the court setting. I turn to the relatives in order to explain, as simply, kindly, clearly as I can, causing as little pain as possible, how the deceased's life ended. I answer their questions. I nod sympathetically. Often, they ask the same questions again and again, as if they can't hear the answers, no matter how hard they listen. The coroner thanks me, and I return to my seat. As I leave, some relatives catch me to ask the same questions, again. I tell them once more that he really didn't suffer. The end came quickly. He probably did not have time to comprehend what was happening. He was otherwise in good health. No, there was no evidence of cancer, and the chest pains he used to complain of were not caused by heart disease. Usually, the coroner then reaches a verdict. Accidental death, suicide, natural causes, misadventure, unlawful killing. The relatives leave, feeling emotionally exhausted, but with a sense that death's formalities are all over now. They have listened and have, hopefully, been listened to. The deceased's case has been fully examined in public, and the reason for and the fact of his passing officially stated. If only the criminal courts had the same degree of humanity. There are few jobs where it's routine to stand up in public and defend your professional opinion in the face of very personal attack. There are, of course, expert witnesses who get the reputation of being a liar for hire. I'm not one of them, and don't like being treated that way by solicitors asking if I might alter my view a little or delete an inconvenient paragraph in my report. When I chose this career, I thought that I would be conveying the truth about the dead to the living, who would be grateful to hear it. But as we approach the new century, I instead was starting to feel like the faithful dog that proudly lays a stick at the feet of his master, only to receive a hearty kick for his efforts. Despite all this, I usually go to court feeling confident. I know my subject. I know my findings. I know my conclusions. But once in the witness box under oath, I have no control over events. The barristers are in control, and when they say I must stay and answer questions, if there is no intervention from the judge, then stay I must. Not long at St. George's, I had an experience in the witness box which was so unpleasant that it gave me many sleepless nights and seemed to point at things to come. I had no idea, when I performed the post-mortem on a rent boy or teenage male prostitute, that this case would not be straightforward. He had been found the night before and had died in hospital. His body looked extraordinary. He was covered in livid bruises, and I do mean covered. He was virtually a definition of that old threat adults shouted at naughty children in my day, "I'll beat you black and blue." I counted 105 bruises and many, many abrasions. The weapon used was a cylindrical metal bar from a set of weights. The bar had cross-hatching at the ends, which was reproduced in some of the wounds. There were abrasions also, where it seemed to me the circular end of the metal bar had been used in a sort of stabbing action. It is unusual for someone to die of bruising, but the 19-year-old victim had sustained a remarkable number of blows. I gave the cause of death as multiple blunt trauma. In fact, once the patient arrived in A&E, he developed a disorder called disseminated intravascular coagulation, which arises from the overactivation of the body's defense system against trauma. This results in the blood clotting mechanisms being overwhelmed, and so further, almost continuous bleeding takes place everywhere, including from vital organs. Shock follows, and in many cases death. I went to the block of flats where the events took place. The young man had been found on the third floor, but he had been beaten on the ninth floor, so he had somehow staggered down 74 stairs before collapsing. I measured the steps and the risers, but it was clear to me that his injuries, except possibly for one or two where he had stumbled on the stairs, were caused because he had been beaten by the iron bar and not because he had fallen downstairs. The defendant, also a male prostitute, also about 19 years old, was actually the deceased's best friend, and they shared the same uncle, who pimped them, or funded them, or both. It has amazed me, over the years, how frequently men, but not noticeably women, will kill their best friend, and brothers commit fratricide even more frequently. In this case, the deceased went to the defendant's flat. They drank all afternoon and evening. The dead lad's extrapolated blood alcohol levels were around twice the drink drive limit. It was just before midnight that a resident on the third floor called an ambulance. She had found the victim lying injured outside her flat. He was taken to hospital, but died less than 12 hours later. What had happened? In my opinion, the friend started to hit the deceased and just could not stop. Eventually, the deceased escaped from his flat and down the stairs. If his attacker had reasoned at all, he had probably reasoned that no one ever dies of thumps and bruises, which is a fallacy. I received notification that I was being called by the prosecution as an expert witness. That was routine, and it felt like a routine case. I did learn that the defense barrister was one I recognized, a particularly persistent tiger, an old tiger actually, but not without teeth. He was known for stalking expert witnesses, but I was still not really concerned. The case was quite straightforward, and I'd probably be in and out of the witness box in a few hours. At a pre-trial conference with the prosecution, counsel had warned me that he would be going through each of the 105 injuries with me. I hoped that after such a marathon, it would be so obvious to the jury why the young man had died that the defense would have no further questions and I would be allowed to go. I took the stand and made my oath. The court had been supplied with copies of some of the post-mortem photos, not as sanitized as the cartoonish images we use today, but nothing too horrific, and each area of bruising was documented and numbered. I had prepared these photographic exhibits and given them to the Crown Prosecution Service well in advance, but as usual, where pictures are concerned, there was a lot of bumbling about. Officials stumbled blindly here and there with the wrong pictures. Judge and jury found they had different ones. People passed pictures to other people, and I had to suppress hysterical laughter at the sheer disorganization of it all. Prosecution counsel began by lulling everyone to sleep as we discussed in detail, as previously agreed, each one of the 105 injuries. In the course of this, I had made two small errors, both picked up in a kindly way by prosecuting counsel. The first was on injury 11, on the right-hand side of the back. Me. Indicating that once again, that injury has been caused by a linear blunt object of similar size to the object that caused the injuries on the left-hand side of the chest. QC. When you refer to the chest, you mean the back. Me. Oh, I do apologize. Yes, I did. Those injuries I have just been talking about are the highlighted injuries to the back. A daft error. And idiotic when I did it again, much later. Me. And as you can see, injury 71 is a 10 by 3 centimeters deep bruise. QC. Now, did you not, in your report, in addition to those numbered injuries, find something else here? Me. Indeed. Once again, as with the chest, I found some area of parallel bruising over the legs. QC. As with the back. Me. As with the back. I'm sorry, you are quite right. I'm confusing the back and the chest. Over the back were, at least, three areas of parallel bruising. Considering the enormity of the crime we were discussing, these mistakes seem small enough. I said back when I meant chest, and was corrected. I don't think I confused the judge, jury, prosecution or defendant. Counsel for the defense, however, must have been rubbing his hands. When the judge asked the defense how long their questions would take, because he was deciding when to give the jury a break, the old tiger said, rather ominously, that since new material had just emerged, it would perhaps be better to have the break now. There was a 20-minute pause, one that chess players might regard as strategic. I spent it wondering just what the new information was. Was it something I had said? I remembered defense counsel's reputation, and sure enough, within a few minutes of our return, defense QC, you have, I think, on two occasions, referred to the chest when you meant the back. Uh-oh, when a QC tries to catch me out on small and insignificant errors to prove to the jury my incompetence early in the cross-examination, then I know that there's trouble ahead. Me. I did indeed, yes. QC. That is a mistake that can be easily made, can it not? Me. Well, yes, it is easy to confuse these things. I tend to consider the back of the chest and the front of the chest. QC. But, Dr. Shepherd, that is not what you said. Me. No, I mistakenly said chest when I meant back. QC. Quite a mistake in its way, is it not? Me. Well, it is a mistake. I'm not sure how quite a mistake it is. QC. Very well. When you are more precise, though, perhaps you expect a higher degree of accuracy. For example, the weight of the metal bar, referring to the murder weapon here, 450 grams, is that right? Me. That is what my notes say. QC. Well, we shall be hearing, no doubt, an admission of evidence that it was 421 grams. Not a great deal turns on the weight, except the accuracy of what you say. I felt myself turning red at this point. Confusing chest and back wasn't serious, but being accused of getting the weight of the alleged murder weapon wrong might look careless to a jury. No time to think about it. Defense counsel, without warning, entirely changed subject. QC. If a man had some drink, it all depends how much and whether he is accustomed to it. It may affect his steadiness of gait. Me. It may. QC. And if he has suffered some physical trauma, blows, that will not improve matters, will it? Me. Well, I think that depends on the blows he has received. QC. Now, Dr. Shepherd, you said the deceased had received about 100 blows, is that right? Me. Very carefully now. That is an approximation. QC. Now follow this through as a logical thought, would you please? You are a doctor. Call to a flat on the 9th floor. You have been told, and you can see a man has had, let us take your evidence at full strength, 105 blows. He says, I want to walk down to the 3rd floor. I know I had a drink. There are 74 steps and 8.5 landings. Would you say, all right, old boy, get going. I'll see you at the bottom. If I hadn't been under oath and giving evidence, I might have laughed. Would the QC, on finding himself on the 9th floor of a block of flats, with a drunken young male prostitute, really address him as old boy? But the real concern for me was, where was this going? After an endless series of further questions about if, how, and why, I would help a drunken rent boy down the stairs in the middle of the night, the QC exploded in a manner oddly reminiscent of my father. QC. Can I come straight to the heart of the matter and not pussyfoot around answering and questioning? You would have wanted to make sure he did not fall down the stairs. 74 of them, would you not? Me. That would be one of my concerns, yes. QC. Yes, because if a man had been subjected to the number of blows you indicated, he might fall. Me. Clearly anyone in that circumstance might fall. QC. Thank you. If he fell on uncarpeted stairs, he might injure himself. Me. Certainly a fall onto the lower stairwell I saw could result in injury. Yes. QC. Yes. Good heavens. Surely the defense was not going to argue that the 105 injuries were virtually all caused by the victim falling downstairs. Surely he would not try to persuade the jury that this was not a murder with the metal bar, but just an unlucky series of falls. The idea was absurd. Counsel asked me to describe the stairwell in minute detail, although in fact the jury had been given pictures of it. I lost count of the number of times he repeated how many stairs there were. I think everyone in court must have dreamed about the number 74 that night. And a fall down these 74 concrete stairs, he kept insisting, could be very serious. I was unable to contradict him, but I didn't believe the deceased's injuries, or at least the fatal ones, resulted from falling downstairs. Then he went back to the injuries. Individually. Again. All 105 of them. One by one, he asked me to prove they had not been caused by the deceased's alleged fall, and one by one, he challenged each answer. This cross-examination amazed me. The deceased had been a drifter, who had lived most of his childhood in and out of care, had probably spent at least some of his subsequent time living on the streets, and had recently been released from jail. The defendant's background was very similar. If either one had ever received a fraction of the public money, care and interest which was devoted to this trial, then I doubt there would have been a murder. As for the defense barrister, it was good he was working so hard to defend a client who was clearly from the margins of society. Had he ever passed the lad huddled in the doorway, I don't expect learned counsel would have looked at him, let alone thrown a coin in his cup. But now the young man was on trial for murder. Legal arguments about him consumed the barrister. I wished he could do his job without attacking my reputation as an expert witness. But I knew that in another case, and with another jury, we might be on the same side. And then, instead of excoriating me, he would be praising my experience and skills. The cross-examination continued for the rest of the day and then carried on the next morning. And the next afternoon. And the following morning. Now, the defense QC wasn't just arguing that the injuries were caused by falling downstairs, but that the cross-hatching from the surface of the iron bar reproduced on the victim's skin was actually simply caused by the warp and weft of his cotton t-shirt. Then, many tea breaks later, as I returned to the witness box ready for a few more rounds with my back against the ropes, I watched him bounce in, a spring in his step and his eyes darting dangerously beneath his wig. I knew the tiger was planning to pounce. QC. Alcohol, I suppose, if you are affected by it, will make you perhaps slightly more liable to bleed than would otherwise be the case. Me. In the chronic alcoholic whose damaged liver may have blood clotting problems, yes, but I found nothing to suggest that is the case here. I believe alcohol would have a very minimal effect. QC. Do you know anything about that as a clinician? Me. No, I do not. QC. Not aware of that. Me. Not particularly. QC. What do you mean, not particularly? Are you aware of it? Me. I am not aware, throughout my experience, of anyone who has suffered significantly more bruising when they are under the influence of alcohol than someone who is sober. That was not the answer Counsel wanted to hear. He argued and argued with me that alcohol dilated the tiny blood vessels on the surface of the skin, which I agreed with, and therefore that drinkers were much more vulnerable to bruising, which I did not. I lost count of the number of times he took me, step by step, through his logical but erroneous deduction that the victim was covered in bruises simply because he had been drinking. I really began to doubt who had been beaten by an iron bar, the victim or me, but I stuck steadfastly to scientific fact. Finally, the QC exploded. QC, where do you get this from? Can you do some research overnight? Me, I can consult the preclinical medical textbooks about the effects of trauma on the skin. QC, what book do you suggest I consult overnight? Me, I would suggest you consult any molecular biology book. I'm afraid I cannot give you a name. QC, aren't you familiar with any? Me, perhaps a textbook by Guyton will help. I cannot tell you which edition is current. I think the third or fourth edition, or any hematology textbook will cover it. QC, any hematology author you can name? Me, not specifically, no. Judge, how many pages is counsel likely to have to read, Dr. Shepherd? Me, I'm afraid I cannot help you with that. QC, it's beyond me, but I shall still have a look. Judge, yes. And pass it to me afterwards, please, counsel. QC, I will, my lud. By now I hated both the QC and the judge, and suspected that they were members of the same chambers, or at least the same London club. Once, when the judge showed impatience with the defence, the QC asked to speak to him without the jury present. The jury, press, public, and I filed dutifully out of the courtroom. When counsel and judge are talking in this way, it usually means that a point of law is being argued, and, on returning, there is a distinctly chilly atmosphere in the court, with one barrister smiling and the other sulking. But these QCs and this judge were all smiling happily when we returned, like pals at a fireside. The defence was trying to explain away the horrific beating the dead lad had received by persuading the jury he had fallen downstairs. Did I mention that there were 74 stairs? And in the course of this, he had become so badly bruised because he'd had a few drinks. I spent the evening feverishly phoning friends to discuss bruising and searching the hospital library for that textbook. The next day, we were at it again. It was all I could do to contain my own homicidal feelings. Defence QC. You referred me and the court to a textbook, Guyton. Me. Indeed. QC. Have you got it with you now? Me. I have a copy now. QC. Do you have the passage you relied upon? Me. I have marked the page that deals with what happens in the body following damage to a blood vessel. QC. You've got it there. Me. Yes, in this particular edition, it is chapter 36. QC. Which edition? Me. I believe the 8th. QC. You had, of course, referred us to the 3rd or 4th edition. Me. I think I said I did not know which edition is most current. QC. May I see it? But I think he had already seen a copy. He asked me endless questions about platelets and clotting in an attempt to prove his point until the jury was nodding off and even the judge interrupted. Judge, please forgive me, but what I would like to ask Dr. Shepherd is, this chapter you referred to, is there something in there which actually says alcohol increases bruising? Me, it is the absence in that book, my lad, and in other books I have consulted, of anything saying alcohol causes increased bruising. It is the absence of those facts. Judge, because if this was a sustainable proposition, you would expect to find it in that book, at that chapter. Me, I would indeed, my lad. That didn't really stop the defence. The QC made his false point in a variety of ways, once, twice, three times more, that alcohol increases capillary blood flow and so bruising must be more likely. A whole week after I took the witness stand, I was allowed to go. What a relief. This case illustrates that there are facts, and there are the conclusions that can be drawn from them. In the adversarial cauldron of that courtroom, truth had turned into an individual, nuanced, malleable commodity, and that is why, as an expert witness, I was pressured to interpret facts in ways I found uncomfortable. Advocacy, the art of a lawyer making his case, need have no conscience. And any bar school would agree that some good cases are lost by poor advocacy, and that some poor